The latest from the state capitol about your own neighborhood. Senator James Maroney stops by Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So we are connecting with Senator Maroney this week, and it's been a couple of weeks since we last spoke. Thank you for coming back on, Senator Maroney. How are you?
Good, thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely. I know a couple of things that we're going to talk about includes the baby bond program. And I was wondering, Senator Maroney, can you just start by giving kind of a footnotes version? What is the baby bond program? It sounds like you're in support of it.
Yes. And so this was passed in one of the previous budgets. It was proposed initially by Treasurer Sean Wooden, our past treasurer. And what it would do is it would invest $3,200 in a savings account for every child born in poverty. And then the indicator they use as poverty would be children born on Husky or on Medicaid.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Approximately 15,000 kids a year. I guess almost half of the births in Connecticut each year are children who are born on Husky or in poverty. And so that money would be invested in an account by the treasurer, and it would grow. And then between the ages of 18 and 30, those children, if they still lived in Connecticut, would be able to access that money for education, investing in a business, purchasing a home, or moving into a retirement account. And so the theory is to help try to build generational wealth. And one of the things we know, from research is that for children who are born in poverty, born in the bottom 20% of income, over 40% of them stay in the bottom 20% of the income tiers for the rest of their life. And 70% of them stay below the bottom 50%. And so, one of the things is, being born in poverty shouldn't be a life sentence. And we want to try to encourage mobility and help people to move up.
Yes, certainly. So I'm curious, Senator Maroney, how much money would be that initial investment?
Yeah. And so the $3,200, $15,000, I think with administrative costs, it'd be about $50 million a year. And that's really what they're trying to figure out is the best way of funding that. Initially, it was thought that they would bond for that money. And there has been some opposition to bonding because bonding, and many people feel that bonding should only be for infrastructure and things that are going to last. Well, some people may argue, and actually in the Build Back Better, they were going to name childcare or early childhood education as infrastructure. But again, they are looking for the funding, another funding source for that.
And the only thing that I question with this, Senator Maroney, because it's not like a constant. We don't know every year how many babies are born, let alone how many of them are born into poverty. Do you think that amount of money is going to run out? And the reason I ask that is because, well, for one thing, we've seen with past programs like the Hero Pay that we ran out of money to give people the initial amount we were going to, right? So I'm just curious if you think that would be enough to cover an amount of children that we don't even know how many we're going to have and how many will be in poverty.
Right. And I think one of the things is, right, that would be an annual appropriation. The hope would be that we have less children being born into poverty, but we don't know, right? And so that would be something that each year you would have to reappropriate. And at some point, I think look at the efficacy of the program, although it'll take a while, right? If you're investing money that they can't access for 18 years, it's at least 20 years before we'll know how effective this program has been. So I don't know how many, the funding in our budgets are only 2 years at a time. Mm-hmm. And so every 2 years, it would really be up for renewal to see if we are going to be able to continue funding that program. Because you're right, all too often we have a program we like and it's a pet project for someone and then it doesn't continue.
So there may actually only be 2 years worth of children who benefit from this.
It's possible. I think that there would be a lot of It would be difficult not to continue it, I would assume, but it is possible because we do appropriate the budget every 2 years. And a legislator can't find a future legislature necessarily.
Right. So. And Senator Maroney, have we seen other states do a baby bond program? Like, have we seen success in another state that's doing this currently?
The exciting thing is Connecticut was the first, and it's being modeled. I think Senator Cory Booker was here the other week with Treasurer Eric Russell, and Treasurer Eric Russell has done a great job picking up with this program and running with it. But Senator Booker was here to discuss it, and he has a proposed federal legislation in, and I believe California may also have proposed legislation to emulate this program. But we are the first. Treasurer Russell did have Professor Leonard Hamilton. I think he's a professor, one of the CUNYs in New York City, up to discuss the program, who had done some research on this, proposing this type of a program. So, but we are a trailblazer when it comes to this program.
Yeah, interesting. And Senator James Maroney, another thing with this, are there ways that people can find a loophole? And I don't want to be the Debbie Downer, but I'm just curious, like, is there a way that parents can put their children on Husky, even though they don't come from poverty? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that the requirements are fairly stringent, for how you would qualify for Husky. So it's income based. The only, I'm not sure, to be honest, if there is a loophole. I think that, you may be able to get on Husky. And I'm not sure, like, if you lose a job, if you're able to go on Husky.
Well, that's what I'm kind of thinking.
Like, on Husky.
Is there a way that you could, like, if one parent, because sometimes you'll have one parent that's with their company and all their benefits and everything, and then what if the mother decides to, if she's a stay-at-home mom, let's just say, she puts herself on Husky for a year and she's pregnant. Like, wouldn't that, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah, I think, like with any program, unfortunately, there may be some loopholes, but we don't want those few rotten apples to spoil the bunch. I think we're looking at, and we know the other thing you hear is, well, what about the kids who may start, their families may start poor, but then they end up, by the time that they're 18, they're making a lot more money. But what we do know is, as I said, over 70% of the kids who are born in poverty stay in the lower income tiers for the rest of their life. And so, I think we want those few exceptions to ruin the program. I think as far as there are probably some loopholes that haven't been thought of. The other thing is there are ways that you may need to look at how you can access the money in 18 years, right? Like if you've moved out of state, it's one of the things we want to make sure it's going to people who are. And those are in the rules, right, that you can only invest in a business in Connecticut or buy a home in Connecticut. But there may be some other things we may want to tighten, and we'll have some time.
That's all I was getting at is I think that the program sounds amazing. Look, I do a lot of work with the Bridgeport Rescue Mission, and when I see the amount of children who go hungry, I know that there are a lot of children who live in poverty. I also know, though, that we live in a very money-hungry society, and people who do not need the money necessarily and will qualify because they're sneaky. And that's what I'm getting at, is I would want to make sure that things are buttoned up so that the children who actually need it and can benefit from it do get it, and then maybe it would be approved for future budgets and everything, even if there's different legislators, because if it's buttoned up and we know it's going to the right children, how do you not support that? How do you not get people on the right foot? So I agree with you. I just don't always trust people, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I think, you bring up good points, but we also ought to, as I said, make sure that we're not necessarily making it too strict, that we're preventing helping those who really need it. And so it is always finding that balance. How do you make sure you're getting the programs to those people who really need them? And I think that they felt that because of the requirements for getting on Husky and the application process, that was a really good proxy for identifying who needs it in a vetting process.
We're talking to Senator James Maroney this morning. And Senator Maroney, switching gears, if you don't mind, let's talk about your latest efforts in addressing early childhood education. What is it that you're working on?
Well, I had proposed a bill to create an early childhood trust fund, which didn't make it out of committee, but there is still the chance to try to get that bill into the budget later on.
That?
I'm still working on that. It would be to just to create a trust fund where companies, we would put some of the tax money from the surplus in there and then have that money to invest in early childhood education. And one of the things we know is the best thing you can do dollar for dollar for workforce development and to increase children's opportunities is high quality early childhood education. There's so many benefits that we've seen, from decrease in the use of special education services, increased likelihood of going to college, decreased potential of a child ending up going to prison or committing a crime. So there's so many benefits, not just for the children, but for society. And then we look at the state right now, and it's estimated Senator Bayh, when she's the former senator, she's now the commissioner of early childhood education, Commissioner Bayh, when she testified to the education committee on the early childhood bill she's proposed, there are over 42,000 women in the state of Connecticut right now who aren't going back to work because they can't find the early childhood education. And we're short 30,000 infant toddler spaces in the state. And I know the other week I went to a ribbon cutting for a Good Child in Milford, opened a center in Orange. And I know that, you know, and they're a reasonable center. They're charging around the average, for early childhood centers in Orange, and they're charging over $500 a week. So that's $25,000 a year for a family send their child. Correct. And then you look at what are we paying. The average salary for the early childhood workers is $29,000 a year. And, you know, again, touring a Good Child in Milford, Bill Okwosa, the executive director there, he had shared with us that, you know, one of his lead teachers who's been there for 29 years, she's making $19 an hour. And so
it doesn't quite compute. Yeah.
No. And we say that, you know, we say that the children are the most important thing to us. Our elderly are the most important thing to us. But there's also that saying, you know, show me your budget and I'll tell you your priorities.
Right.
And then when we look at what we pay our people who work with the elderly or people who work in early childhood education, you know, something needs to get changed. So, you know, during the pandemic, there have been subsidies for wages. They've done some wage supplements, which had helped in recruiting teachers. But again, we still have, I think we've lost over 20% of the capacity from pre-pandemic. And the early childhood workers, they were going in. They were the reason that the nurses, the police, the firemen, those first responders could go to work. They still needed to bring their children somewhere, right, to watch them. And
right,
so,
exactly.
They're what they call the workforce behind the workforce, and we need to find ways to make sure that it's affordable for families, and then that we're able to pay the workers more. And that's where really the only way you could do that is with some form of a state subsidy.
But this current form did not make it out of the committee. So you were saying in some form, it might pop up elsewhere, or what do you mean?
It might pop up, and then there are a couple of really good bills in the House on early childhood that
I'll be focusing on.
Right, that they're looking at expanding eligibility for Care for Kids. Care for Kids is, you know, a program right now you're only eligible for it if you have 60% of the state median income. So they want to go a little higher on that. So, you know, Representative Paris and Representative Cook are co-chairs of the Early Childhood Caucus. And so the caucus put forward a bill that does a lot of great things. But as with anything we've seen in the state, it comes down to funding, right, and finding the budget for that. So looking at increasing reimbursements to the centers, looking at increasing, you know, eligibility. There are a number of things that they're looking to do. And,
right.
You know, in the budget, the governor's proposal, so in the department's bill, it does a lot of things. They're adding new slots, adding 1,300 infant toddler slots, although, I know that was last year we added. We still need to add more infant toddler slots because we're short, you know, some estimates say we're short 30,000 slots.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's still a big problem. So definitely still an uphill battle, but we appreciate getting the update on what's happening in this regard during the legislative session. And Senator Maroney, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I know we'll be checking in with you again in just a couple of weeks. So thank you so much for coming on and talking about these items. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, thanks for having me, Melissa. Have a great day.
Absolutely. You too. Senator James Maroney here on WICC.
What's going on in the Capitol? And how it affects you. State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the morning right now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Senator Wong, we're going to dive right into the Connecticut budget negotiations and looking at where everyone's standing, whether it's the governor, the Democratic majority, the Republican alternatives. Let's get right into it this morning. How are you?
I am wonderful. Good morning, Melissa. You know, before we even talk about the budget, what was important, it's important to note that when we first got in January, the first thing we voted on was to implement and reinstate the spending cap for bonding and for spending, which was facilitated in a bipartisan budget with the governor nearly 5-6 years ago. And it was bipartisan, Democrat, Republicans, and we put in spending caps to live within our means, to set priorities in the budget. And what we have resulted in the past 5-6 years is a record surplus and bond ratings and fiscal ratings that have lifted our state in regards to where we are right now. What we did in January and February was institute that cap for another 5 years that says to borrowing and to the general public that we are going to live within our means and spend appropriately within the cap and borrow within our cap. And that is the foundation of where we are right now. The governor in February proposed a budget that was within the cap, and it facilitated a discussion. There were a lot of unhappy people in regards to limitations in borrowing, which is bonding, and spending, which is appropriations. And what we did for the next 2 months was the Appropriations Committee with the Democratic majority chairs and the bonding committee with the majority Democratic chairs worked through the legislative and now just proposed their budget last week. Now, their budget is approximately $400 million more than what the governor had proposed. And it exceeded the governor's cap in regards to spending. Now, the cap was, it could very easily be superseded and exceeded.
I was just going to say, like, how easy is it to get rid of that?
We've done it year after year after year. And I must give credit to the governor pushing back and saying, look, we need to live within our means. And as even Senator Maroney says, budgeting is about priorities and the essence of how we prioritize our spending. So there are a couple of gimmicks that was proposed in the Democratic budget, which is called intercepts. The intercepts is we're going to take revenue and we're not going to count it against the budget so it doesn't go against the cap. It's like you.
Then what does it go against? Like, that's kind of weird. That's almost like saying, okay, so I, you know, so for example, like, you know, here at the radio station, I make a certain income. And then when I get endorsement deals, we get extra money from those endorsements. I still have to put it in my budget. I still have to do it, even though it's not technically, like, we don't know we're going to get money from that, you know?
That's the crux of
that's crazy.
What the governor called a gimmick. And it doesn't count against the gap of the cap. And that's the frustration. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of really important programs that are needed. Education,
right, but we can't go broke. Healthcare. You know, that's why we have a budget. I mean, there's a lot of things we'd all love to spend money on, but that's why humans should have a budget. That's the whole reason.
But it's also human to spend and to desire to accomplish things. And that's the crux of the challenge, right, is that There are tremendous needs. Our nonprofits are important. Our colleges are important. Our education systems throughout all our school districts are important. Care for our most, the safety net of our society are critical. They all have needs. But at the same time, you've got to live within your means and the challenges. And that's the argument that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the governor made a commitment to offer tax relief, middle class tax relief. Now, that has been dwindled down to a quarter point tax cut. The governor had looked at a 1 point percentage tax cut, and that's been dwindled down. And I think the governor's focus has been tax relief for taxpayers that have been feeling the burden of affordability concerns. And that's something that I share equally with him as well, is the fact that Connecticut is absolutely unaffordable, and we need to look at ways to reduce costs, but at the same time, be able to give relief for people that are struggling every single day.
So I wonder, why would they lower that then? Like, why would they lower the middle class tax cut?
Because we need the money. You need revenue. Yeah. If you lower taxes, you take in less revenue, and our spending doesn't match up. So the Democratic legislative budget reduced the percentage of tax cuts. You still have a tax cut, but it's less than what the governor's proposed, and that is one of the impetus to lead Republican legislators in both the House and the Republican to work right now and maybe propose later on this week a tax and budget that offers tax relief for middle-class citizens. You're right, because if you give people tax cuts, you're going to take in less revenue for government. And that's the challenge, right? But I think the priority has to be you need to give relief to an overburdened public that has to deal with energy costs, inflation, and the challenges of government and the increasing taxation on their ability to live in the state. So Republicans in the House and the Senate are going to look to propose a budget that live within the means without any, hopefully, gimmicks, but at the same time, live within our means and set priorities and give middle-class tax relief.
Remind me, Senator Huang, when is the legislative session officially done? It's June, right?
June 9th.
Yeah.
The first full Wednesday of June, because it's the long session and the budget.
Right.
The budget will be the focal point, but there were over 2,000 bills proposed.
Which is just insane. Yeah.
And it goes the range of gamuts of critical issues, but it also reflects a lot of constituency advocacy in a budget year that anybody, any legislator can propose bills. So we had over 2,000 to review and vet, and the committee process kind of whittled down to like 500 that were joint favorably or approved by the majority of the members in each of the respective committees. And those are the bills under review. A lot of the bills that have fiscal notes, meaning costing money, will have to go to appropriations for review. That look at bonding impact will go to finance. So we're still reviewing those. And some of those may not pass the test in regards to fiscal accountability. But nevertheless, we usually pass around 200 bills to 250 bills a year. But the challenge is vetting those bills. And what has happened this year, Melissa, it's interesting, is we're coming out of the first full year out of COVID protocols of a hybrid and virtual kind of meeting. So we have legislators that have never went through that committee process.
Right.
So unfortunately, this year, more than any, there are a lot of work-in-progress bills, which were passed out of committee with the recognition and the agreement that there is going to continually work on some of the challenges that we weren't fully able to vet out. It's an unusually high number of work-in-progress.
I was just going to ask you, like, do we usually – I mean, I know it's always – an insane amount of bills, but I mean, a couple thousand, that's a lot. It's a lot.
You know what? 500 seems to be the number, but this year, unusually, out of the 500, a significant percentage of them are work in progress, which means there's still a lot of meetings and review and research that needs to go into it. We really kind of had to readapt to the committee process with a lot of new chairmen and new ranking members. So we have a lot of work in the next 5 weeks to really kind of vet out what the bill's intent and impact fiscally, as well as, impacting people whose lives will be impacted by laws we passed. So it's really a lot of work ahead of us. But that being said, it really goes back to the budget. The budget dictates all the things that we do. And the problem is, as you have heard me many times in your program, is when the budget comes out, it's 1,000 pages, and even Senator Maroney pointed to it, that the bill that he had, which was very well-intentioned, did not get out of committee.
But so now it might get sneaked. It might sneak back into something else. I know. I kind of, he said
and,
it point
and
blank.
That's kind of a matter of factly, and that's frustrating, is the fact that you don't have the full review process, the public hearing process. If a bill didn't pass the muster, we're going to find another way and insert it. And what we've had in the past, and the frustration is, the budget comes out with its implementer.
It's either yay or nay.
We have
right.
to vote on it. And then it includes bills that never got out of committee. And it really becomes law without the due process of what the integrity of the review process is. That's my frustration, is the fact that, but again, the majority can control the agenda, control the writing. We can offer input as a minority member and object to it. But nevertheless, it's business as usual, and that's a frustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and unfortunately, I would imagine that this is done in governments in every state. I mean, regardless of what the party is, whoever the majority is. I mean, having like implementer bills, I seems like that's a standard. Unfortunately, like that seems, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
And but the key is you can put them in, and it's prerogative. To have hours before we have to vote on a
package that's
like that.
Insane.
It's frustrating. And the challenge is, it's not good representative government.
Yeah.
It's not fully transparent. It's not fully accountable to the impact on people. It's the frustration. And let's go back. When we had a bipartisan 18-18 Senate, we were able to vet and collaborate and create the bonding limits and the spending limits that led to the surplus that we have. When you have challenges, and I say this all the time to the public, is look, I'm not even the boss of my own household.
Right.
Because households need collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have give and take. There's respect and exchange of ideas. It isn't one way, and that's the problem with the one-party government that we have.
I mean, I think that's the brokenness of
national
politics
rhetoric.
Today. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the brokenness of politics in general. I think even, you know, which is, I won't even go down that rabbit hole of whether or not you even need parties. And to me, I think even representation in Washington, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, I think it does such a disservice to Connecticut residents that we only have Democratic representation. I think it's a disservice to Floridians that they only have Republicans representing them. And you know, so I've always questioned why, even on a national level, we don't have some bipartisan, like forced bipartisan, if you will. Like, why aren't we sending at least 2/3 of our, you know, like, or 2 out of 5 of our congressmen or women? Why aren't they Republican? And same thing for our House and our Senate here in Connecticut. Why isn't it closer in the split? You know, and I get that it's a democracy. I understand that. But I do think you're going to continue to see the things you're frustrated about as long as you have a supermajority, which we've had.
The divisiveness in politics is toxic.
Yeah, it
it's
is.
It's counterproductive. For me, I'm very, very proud to be a Connecticut Republican. But I'm most proud of representing the people in the 28th district within my community. And that includes Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Green Party. I have a responsibility to represent my district.
Right.
That's
the representative, all politicians
right?
Right.
I'm their representative to be their voice up there. And it shouldn't be a party dictated value principle. Affordability an ability to raise your family and live within your means, have a productive life and community and
just
a
logical
job that can give you the securities of that what you need, those are fundamental. There's no value or party principle to it. I'm just incredibly privileged to represent the community as their representative in Hartford.
Well, Senator Wong, I appreciate you pointing this out, the bills that are still sitting, and we'll see what ends up happening in these next few weeks as we continue on with the legislative session set to wrap up in the beginning of June. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Some big national news, and it has connected to us even here in Connecticut because we've seen our last couple of locations start to shut down. Bed Bath & Beyond closing, and this is not the first department store we've seen shut down. In recent years, we saw other big box stores like Toys R Us, for example, Babies R Us, so many that have decided to close their doors for good. And so this morning we're talking to the Better Business Bureau of Connecticut because they have tips on what do you do when a business closes for good and just keeping an eye out on protecting yourselves with purchases. So good morning to you, Kristen Johnson. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So what are some things that people should be thinking about when a store suddenly closes?
So you want to make sure you keep all your receipts, your proofs of purchase, documentation. Now that Bed Bath & Beyond has actually filed for bankruptcy, a lot is going to be left up to the courts, including any claims you have for refunds or money from the business. So you're actually going to have to file that now in bankruptcy court to try to get your money back. And if you go to BBB.org, look up Bed Bath & Beyond, we have some information right up at the top that'll show you the address that you need to send that to. But definitely make sure that you're keeping all your documentation. That being said, Bed Bath & Beyond did announce that they would only accept refunds for items purchased through Tuesday, April 25th.
Okay.
If you purchase something up until April 25th, you are allowed to get that refund. However, starting April 26th, that's when their store closure sale started, and that was final sale.
Do stores make this very clear ahead of time? Like with Bed Bath & Beyond, I kind of felt like that was only a couple of days, and I had listeners who said to me, I had no idea. I don't have time to go in the next couple of days. Do they give that much of a heads up, or no, not really, because they want to make the most money in their last couple of weeks?
You're right. In this case, they literally made the announcement, I think, Sunday, and you had until Tuesday to use your coupons to buy anything where you could get a refund. Now, you do have until May 8th to use your gift cards. The courts ultimately will make that decision as well. If you hang on to your gift card, the court will decide whether or not you can get money for that gift card after the stores close permanently, but I wouldn't take that chance. At this point, if you have a gift card, I would use it because the store has already said they will accept it until May 8th. You also want to look at your warranties. If you have a warranty for an item you bought at the store, look into whether that came from the manufacturer or actually the store that issued the warranty. If it came from the manufacturer and the manufacturer is still in business, then you're fine. You're safe. But if it's through Bed Bath & Beyond, you're going to be out of luck once that store closes. Now, they are looking for a buyer, so I guess there is a slim chance a buyer could scoop them up and keep the stores open or keep an online presence. But we just don't know what's going to happen in the future, and they have already started their closing sales. So that gives an indication that the future may be looking bleak.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking to Kristen Johnson about when businesses close. Now, of course, we had Bed Bath & Beyond is probably the most recent we've seen, but I have a very strong feeling that this is not the end of big box stores closing. It's just kind of inevitable. We've seen this happen many, many times in the past, and unfortunately, we will probably see it again. Now, Kristen, what if you need to return items? What happens? Are you sort of out of luck? Especially if, what if they still have an online platform? They just have closed the actual locations in person.
So if you go to Bed Bath & Beyond's website, they have a frequently asked questions section that answers this and many other questions, such as the gift card question. And what they say is anything purchased through April 25th is eligible for a refund. Anything purchased after April 25th is not. It's final sale. It should say that on your receipt. There should be a sign in the store. So that's pretty clear. Those are your two options. I actually, personally, I can tell you a story. I purchased a couple of things from Bed Bath & Beyond online from their marketplace and decided I wanted to return them. This was before they made the announcement that they were closing. One of the items I was able to return and get a refund. The other one, they said, just keep it. And they gave me the refund. They said, we don't even want it back. Just
donate
it.
Wow. That's amazing.
And it was over $100.
Yikes. That's...
Yeah.
Now, is there a way that you could resolve like a transaction issue like that, or no? Like once they filed for bankruptcy and they're like case closed, like is that you just have to eat that money?
Once they file for bankruptcy, you can continue to make a claim, but it has to be in the bankruptcy court. So it's no longer, you know, they no longer have the assets. It's no longer up to them. The court will decide how everyone gets paid out, including all the people that they owe, whether it's a consumer or a lender. And so that's why it's important to go to BBB.org, look up Bed Bath & Beyond, and there's a little paragraph at the top that says, if you have a claim against this business, it needs to be filed in New Jersey in the bankruptcy court where they filed for bankruptcy.
Interesting. Kristen, this is the last thing I was going to ask you, you know, because sometimes if you tried to return something or you felt you were duped or like the, you know, whatever contract or, you know, when you read the fine print, I should say, It doesn't make it very clear. Sometimes people will go to their credit cards or their banks and say, like, don't let them charge that. Can you do that, though, in this situation?
You may be able to. You might
really
be able to dispute the transaction if you don't receive the goods or services. You have much better luck if you purchased it with a credit card than a debit card. Credit cards always offer the most consumer protection. But if you used a debit card, you can also contact your bank and see if they can help you out. That's especially important if it's a big ticket item, if you're owed a lot of money. Don't give up. At least try.
And Kristen, if anybody wants more information, what is your website? What is a way that they could learn more and contact you?
BBB.org, pretty easy to remember. You know, just a week prior, we heard that David's Bridal is also filing for bankruptcy. They're looking for a buyer. They're hoping to stay open. But we've got some good tips on BBB.org. If you are a bride, bridesmaid, if you ordered a prom dress through them, these tips also apply because they also filed for bankruptcy. They are hoping to keep their stores open. So we've got some tips on there for you as well that I think could be very helpful.
All right, Kristen. Well, I really appreciate your time on this topic. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you soon.
Have a great day.
You too. Kristen Johnson with the Better Business Bureau serving Connecticut right here on WICC.